This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wirednews. Coming up today, why the FBI's unlocking of a terrorist's iPhone is bad news for everyone, the world goes crazy for Tesla's Model 3, and why Microsoft is so obsessed with bots. You're listening to episode 261 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton. Joining me are Matthew Burgess.
Hello.
And Emily Reynolds.
Hi.
How are we? I've done it again.
Every week.
I know.
Every
Today week. Is April Fool's.
It is.
Which has been great fun.
The worst day of the year, in my opinion.
Yep. There's been some crackers and also some fairly bad ones. Matt, actually, you found one that was all right.
I quite liked H&M's new line of clothes, which is the Mark Zuckerberg range.
So blue jeans and a grey t-shirt?
Yeah, seven.
Sort of muscle shirt.
Seven t-shirts and a pair of basic jeans.
So you sort it every day of the week?
Yeah.
And but apart from that, it's all been terrible.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the good April Fool's jokes.
We were speculating that maybe the internet has made April Fool's worse because it's made it so easy for everyone to come up with these jokes that so many bad ones. Every company feels like it has to do one. And it just becomes a really irritating nightmare. But if you spotted any good ones, let us know at YGK on Twitter. All right, a thing you learned this week. Matt Burgess?
I've learned this week, and this is one of these ones where I'm going to make you guess what I've sort of learned. But one of the 11 boring machines, which was used to create the Channel Tunnel, was
How boring were they? Sorry. No. Carry on.
Was sold on eBay. It was sold on eBay in 2004, so this isn't a new fact, but it was sold on there. And how much was it, Emily?
So this is like a huge crunching piece of
how
machinery.
How big is it? Do we have any
big enough
sense
to dig
of scale?
The Channel Tunnel?
It's probably quite big. I'm going to say, I'm going to go for £1.3 million.
I'm just going to go a little bit above that. I'm going to go for £26 million.
You're both completely way out.
Excellent.
It was £39,999.
Huh.
That's really cheap.
So is it that maybe they're just not worth that much? I mean, what are you going to do with one? Dig some tunnels.
Dig a hole, dig some tunnels. Yeah.
We could probably crowdfund to get one of them.
Yeah, we could have rustled up enough for our own massive boring machine. Next time. Emily, what did you learn?
Okay, so this is one of those facts that sounds really fake, but after some investigation, I found out that it was true. And, you know, it's quite interesting. So I learned this week that there are more trees on Earth than there are stars in the Milky Way.
Makes you think.
It does make you think. So there are between 100 and 400 million stars in the galaxy, and there are 3 trillion trees on Earth, which is a lot of trees.
400 for every human. I'm going to preempt your question there.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is nice. So we've all got 400 trees. We should go find them.
I don't know what I'd do with my trees.
What's your favourite kind of tree?
Oh, God.
The larch.
And it's not. I go for the willow.
I don't think I have a favourite kind of tree, but I'll get back to you next week.
Good. I can't wait. I learned this week that Britain started selling opium to China to get back the silver it paid to China to fuel the British obsession with tea. So this was when tea first started getting imported from China. Britain was giving China so much silver that it ran out of silver. So it had to find something to trade to the Chinese to get the silver back, which is kind of monstrous, really. It did it through an illegal trade in opium.
That is a very depressing fact.
Yeah, so there we go. That's something I learned this week, which is nice. Matt, we're going to talk about it again, Apple versus the FBI. It came to a slightly unexpected sort of conclusion earlier this week. Tell us some more.
Apple's fight with the FBI is now sort of over. It's not fully over, but on Monday this week, the US Department of Justice, which is in charge of the FBI, announced that it accessed the data on the phone, or the iPhone, of the San Bernardino terrorist, Syed Farouk. And this basically stopped a court case, which has been going on and rumbling and sort of been in a public sphere and public argument for the last few weeks. And them unlocking the phone basically meant that they have, this court case is not going to go on anymore. And we don't really know what's sort of coming next or how they did it.
Yeah, so that's the big question here is they've come out and said, don't worry, guys, we've unlocked this guy's iPhone, which they previously said was impossible to do without Apple's help, which is why they took them to court and got into such a public argument over it. Now they've done it, but they haven't said how because that information is classified.
Yeah, so The Guardian reported that the technique that they were using has been classified. The Department of Justice hasn't actually confirmed this yet. The only thing that they've really said is that they had the help of a third party. And it's believed a third party that was a company called Cellebrite, which is a Israeli forensic security company. They may have actually helped access the data on the phone, but we don't actually know. This is still a rumour, and there are people saying that this company hasn't helped them. Mm. So it's a case of somebody out there has helped the FBI to access the data on the phone, which they said only Apple could do before, and now they've magically done it.
So you spoke to a leading security research expert at a university in Tel Aviv, and she said that while she didn't know if Cellebrite was involved, that there's a good chance, or it was quite likely, that they had something to do with it.
Yeah, so I spoke to a few experts on this area this week, and all of them said they didn't really know how it's been done yet. But Karen El-Azari, who is the security researcher in Tel Aviv, said she didn't know how this has actually happened, but the company could have been involved. They've used techniques that potentially could do this, and they have a long history of working with the FBI. But it's one of these things about the whole case is we know so little about what's actually happened, how they've accessed the data, the method that was used, and what data they accessed, and if it was really any use to them.
Well, I guess it was of use, or well, it was what they were looking for, because they've dropped the court case, so they must have got sufficient information from that phone. And the really, really big question now is, will that method work on other phones? And the FBI Department of Justice haven't said whether it will or not.
No, they said it was too premature to actually work out if this was going to be able to be used on other phones, because the phone in case was one iPhone 5C running iOS 9, so a very specific phone running a very specific version of iOS. But there are multiple other cases going through the US systems at the moment where the FBI are trying to get into different types of phones, different types of iPhones, running different types of iOSs. So it's a case of, will this work across other devices? And that's what we don't know. And there have been calls for Apple to actually, for the FBI to reveal this data so Apple can look at the security issue that's been made available and potentially solve it.
So one person you spoke to was Bruce Schneier, who's a very, very prominent security researcher and expert who is a fellow at Harvard, amongst other places. What did he have to say about what's now happening with this Apple? Essentially, it's a flaw in their operating system that Apple probably doesn't even know is there.
Yeah, so I spoke to Bruce about this, and I'm going to quote him directly on this one, and it's a fairly longish quote, but he said, "The FBI was right to use an existing vulnerability and not force Apple to create a new one. But now we have to fix it because the security everyone who uses an iPhone, which includes a lot of FBI agents, congressmen, and people who keep our critical infrastructure secure, they're all vulnerable to this, and we need to fix it."
Which is a fairly good point. And this was something that came up in the Edward Snowden leaks of a couple of years ago, that agencies like the NSA and I suppose the FBI and GCHQ and associated agencies in the United Kingdom use undisclosed vulnerabilities in software and hardware to carry out surveillance and to attack targets. And it's in their interests to not disclose those because they're useful. But they have the dual responsibility of also needing to make that infrastructure secure for the people that use it. So they're kind of caught in this very awkward middle ground where they need the exploits to exist to exploit them, but they need to fix them because they're dangerous.
Yeah, so if the exploit that does exist, and again, we don't know what this exact one is, if it can be applied across other phones, other operating systems, then there is a danger to anybody who is using that setup. And that's, again, where we really don't know, and why the FBI and the Department of Justice should at least tell Apple, maybe not make this public, but it's a case of Apple should be able to know this to be able to fix their own software. And that's where the sort of balance in this whole sort of case comes up over who can have access to people's data and what the balance between privacy and security and national security is.
Yeah, and that opens it up to everyone. It's not just about this one iPhone, and that's something that everyone you spoke to was very clear about, that these kind of actions have huge implications for the privacy of all of us. And as most of us use smartphones, they have this data on them. There was a separate case to do with Apple. A father in Italy whose adopted son died has written to Tim Cook asking him to unlock his dead son's iPhone because it has photographs and messages and information stored on it that he can't access. So now that there's been one very high-profile example of someone asking Apple to unlock an iPhone, it looks like this is now going to become a much bigger issue, and companies are going to need to come up with a good response. Apple's response to the FBI was no, but what's its response to a father whose adopted son has passed away from leukemia? It's incredibly complicated. So, briefly, what's next in this ongoing case?
So this exact case has sort of has pretty much finished, unless they actually come out and say what the security company was that helped them, or who the third party was that helped them, or the actual method. But there are other cases that are ongoing. I think the FBI has been asked, has asked Apple in at least 11 other cases to actually unlock phones of different iOSs and different makes. And there's probably going to be another court case. And if the FBI wants to set a precedent where it actually creates a court judgment, a ruling, a legal precedent to actually be able to tell Apple to create a way into their phones, which could apply across other companies and cases as well, they will need another case to do this. So watch this space, I think.
It's going to run and run. Emily, you've been a bit quiet, but this week you were looking at some exoplanets, and one in particular.
I have, yeah. This week we got some of the clearest pictures back from NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope of an exoplanet called 55 Cancri E, which is not the catchiest name, and it's an exoplanet just outside our solar system.
So that means that, relatively speaking, we can see it kind of clearly.
We can, yeah. And it showed a planet of, the researchers called, of two halves. So because it's tidally locked, that means it always shows the same face to its parent star.
Yeah.
So one side is incredibly hot and always, you know, it's always day on one side and it's always night on the other. So the day side can reach up to 2,500 degrees Celsius.
And which is pretty warm.
It is. And so as a result of that, it's completely molten and has no atmosphere. But the other side is solid and cooler and it has an atmosphere.
But not a lot cooler. It's about 1,000 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, it's relatively speaking not that cool, but compared to the other side.
Yeah, and this is an exoplanet that we've known about for quite a long time because it is so close. And there's been a lot of research done into it and different theories about its kind of makeup. But the key thing here is we still don't really know what it's made of, even though we've got a much clearer idea of perhaps what it looks like.
Yeah, so the lead author of the study basically said what we've learned from the images is that we know nothing about it. So he said the images are like adding another brick to the wall, but we actually have no idea about its composition because previously people have suggested it was a water world. And
which is obviously not true.
That it might host life, which it obviously doesn't. And it was called the Diamond Planet because people thought it was made up of diamonds. People suggested it was made up of hydrogen and helium, but basically we don't know.
And that's one of the things with exoplanets. There are so many out there that, and they're all can have different shapes, different sizes. Shapes is probably the wrong word for that, but
yeah. Well, there's lots of research going on about into exoplanets. So Kepler, which is another one of NASA's telescopes, has been searching for exoplanets for the last 20 years, and they've found nearly 2,000 and had 5,000-6,000 discoveries of different forms. So
yeah, so when the first exoplanet was discovered, this was a huge moment of scientific revelation, and since then it's almost become normal for us to find exoplanets, and we know so little about so many of them. But there has been speculation based on the kind of light that we see coming back off them and the distance and the way they orbit around stars. Some whiz around stars at unimaginably high speeds. Some are completely molten. Some are unimaginably huge, almost stars themselves. They're locked in really weird orbits and behave in such strange ways that the concept we have of what a planet is changing all of the time. And I guess this is another example of a planet that's unlike anything on our solar system. It's half molten, it's half solid, it's tidally locked. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, and NASA are obviously very interested in it because this week they also announced that they're building an exoplanet hunter, they called it. So it's going to search for planets like Earth that orbit stars, and they're going to measure the gravitational wobble, which is the technical term, of orbiting planets. So apparently the size of the wobble can indicate the size of the planet. And then once we've kind of ascertained a little bit about that, telescopes like Kepler and Spitzer will then investigate. And they're hoping potentially we could find some kind of life out there.
This is the really interesting thing about the hunt for these exoplanets, is that we're so obsessed with finding a new Earth, finding another Earth. As someone that's a big fan of Battlestar Galactica, that's a really big plot point in that, that we're just desperate to find another world like the one that we live on. But that's really hard, because the Earth is very, very small, and these exoplanets are phenomenally far away.
Yeah, and we basically, as a researcher said, know nothing about them, so I guess it's quite exciting to find out what's out there.
Yeah, and I suppose as telescopes get better and we get better and better at finding information about exoplanets, we're going to really learn so much more about the possibilities of planetary development and structures of planetary systems and the stars that they orbit around. So we'll be keeping an eye on that one for sure. This week, Tesla announced the Model 3, which is its first mainstream, I'm going to use air quotes for that, electric vehicle, because it does cost $30,000 or about $35,000 and around £30,000 in the UK. But despite that, around 150,000 pre-orders have already been placed. You have to put down $1,000 for the car. And I don't know if you guys saw any of the unveiling that Tesla made, in fact, earlier today, but it was almost like a religious ceremony. It was incredibly bombastic, and they're obviously hugely excited about this car.
Yeah, this is a launch that's been hyped for a few weeks and actually months now, I think. And is it one that's being done in several parts as well?
Yeah, so if Tesla and Elon Musk are good at one thing, it's building hype around their products. And that's partly because what they've made so far has been not unobtainable, but in very limited numbers and at very high prices. So the 150,000 pre-orders that have already been placed would, if everyone paid up in full, be the equivalent of $5 billion in sales. That's and would require Tesla to build three times the number of cars that it managed to build in 2015, which is ridiculous.
So why are 150,000 people so excited about this car?
A lot of its price. So $35,000, £30,000 is a lot cheaper than what Tesla has put out before. The Model 3 will have a range of 215 miles before it needs charging, and it will go from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. So it's a decent electric car. It will feel like you're driving a normal, again, air quotes, car. It will also work with Tesla's Supercharger network, which are the charging stations that Tesla's popping up all over the US, and there's a few in the UK, that allow these cars to charge in minutes rather than hours. There's a problem that Tesla can't build enough of these superchargers and they're getting a bit gridlocked, but that's a really important thing, that when your car runs out, it's almost just like filling it up with petrol. It'll also have a 15-inch touchscreen, autopilot, and space for, I would imagine, 5 quite well-acquainted adults. So it's a family saloon. It's a car. And it's first mass-market electric vehicle, but obviously not the first mass-market electric vehicle, because the incumbent car companies, the likes of General Motors and Nissan and BMW, have already either released or are working on their own electric vehicles, both unaffordable and affordable.
Yeah, so they seem to have actually a very ambitious plan for the car as well, which you would if you were launching what you want to be a mainstream leading product. They want to make 500,000 Model 3s by the year 2020, but is that something that they can do to actually make money on it, or is it a case of how are they going to make money on that?
So it's half a million Model 3s a year by 2020. So to do that and to meet its ambitions for its other cars, Tesla will need to make as many batteries in a year as the entire world made in 2013. So this is no small feat for a company that's never released a really, really big mass market car. So the challenge for Tesla is huge expansion of its facility in Fremont, California, and the completion of its ludicrously big gigafactory battery plant under construction in Nevada. And that's really crucial for Tesla turning a profit on these cars. In order to turn a profit on the Model 3, it needs to really drive down the cost of the battery that goes into that. To do that, it needs to make them at huge scale, which is expensive. So in 2015, Tesla posted a net loss of $889 million, and that was partly because it spent $718 million on research and development. And the sort of machinery that it uses is kind of ridiculous. So Michael Rundle, who's just behind the wall, went to Tesla's Fremont factory in California a couple of months ago, and he saw the huge hydraulic pressure punching machine that makes panels for cars, and it can make 5,000 panels a day, applying 10,000 tons of force. It's the largest press of its kind in North America, and essentially it's just a giant thing that punches bits of car car out of aluminium. It's incredible the scale at which they already operate and how that's not enough to turn a good profit on the cars that it's making. And as I also mentioned, Tesla's got some pretty big competition. So in January, General Motors announced the Chevrolet Bolt, which will cost about $30,000 and will be probably the first mass market electric vehicle out there. There's also cars being developed by Nissan, Volkswagen, Toyota. The list goes on. So Tesla's got some pretty tough competition, but people are obviously really excited about the Model 3. They've been queuing up to place pre-orders for a car that will be made in limited numbers in 2017 and probably not be available to most people for a couple of years after that.
Yeah, they've got a big job on their hands. It's going to be a while until we see these cars on the road, but
yeah. I mean, I quite often see hybrid cars popping around the inner cities in San Francisco and London and elsewhere. But they still feel quite niche.
Yeah, I actually get quite excited when I see an electric car charging at the side of the road in London. It just seems quite a rarity. You maybe see one a month and it's just like, oh, look, there's actually somebody using an electric car here.
Yeah, and quite often they're the little kind of smart car style vehicles that don't look like proper cars. So this is why I think people are really excited about the Model 3 and similar cars being developed by other manufacturers, is you don't have to sacrifice the things that people really like about nice cars, about having a good entertainment system, comfortable space for a whole family, and a big enough boot to store your shopping, that kind of thing. So it's taking what at the moment is quite a niche and expensive thing, and within the next few years, making it mass market. And that's maybe going to mean that it will be more than just the odd electric vehicle that we see on our roads. Still to come, on Wednesday, Microsoft kicked off its annual Build conference in San Francisco with a big focus on bots. We'll discuss the company's big plans after the break with Matt Reynolds, which also means we're saying goodbye to Emily Reynolds.
Bye.
This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more, all with a single integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. We can't wait to see what you make of it.
Welcome back. Microsoft is betting big on bots. After a less than successful trial of its Tay Twitter AI, the company used an otherwise unremarkable opening to its Build conference to present its vision for the future of how we interact with computers. It's a pretty big vision. Matt Reynolds, you followed the conference. Tell us some more about it.
So the interesting bits of Microsoft Build 2016, like you said, James, were all about bots. So Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella went as far as saying that bots are the new apps. In his keynote speech, he'd like to build a future where instead of using apps to do things like book taxis or order food, we'll complete these tasks by chatting with our personal digital assistant, which for Microsoft is Cortana.
So Cortana is it's Microsoft Siri, it's Microsoft's Google Now. You ask it questions and it's pulling information from other bits of the operating system and presenting them to you. And this is the sort of thing that Google and Apple and Facebook and others are experimenting with. The idea that a smartphone interface is kind of fiddly and that you should just be able to ask it a question, like I would ask you, do you know a good pub nearby, and you just tell me. I wouldn't have to search for pubs near me and then find one on a list. That's the change that Microsoft are looking for.
Exactly. So what Microsoft's vision is really conversation as a platform. That's exactly what Nadella referred to it. So instead of tapping and inputting text and navigating in apps, we'd interact with our phones exactly like you said, James, just by asking a question.
So let's stop it there. I talk to my phone at home sometimes, but it's a bit fiddly and often I don't. So the action of sending a text message, okay, Google, send a message to this person, and then what would you like to say? And then you say it and it gets it wrong and ask you, and it's a bit fiddly. But with the technology improving, do we reckon that we'll want to talk to our phones more? Because this is kind of the problem with this ambitious plan. People have to actually want to talk to the things.
Yeah, and it's whether they talk back as well. That's one of the big things at the moment, because we are very much at a stage where this is very early. And if you are trying to speak to Siri or Cortana or any of these systems, it's very much almost seems like it's an input device at the moment. There doesn't seem to be too much of a conversation that actually happens, but that's what companies are actually trying to move on and actually create, I guess.
So for you, is that what's standing in the way between these voice-operated operating systems really, really taking off and being useful for you? Is that they feel like a conversation?
It's more public embarrassment, to be honest.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
Talking to my phone as I walk down the street.
And if everyone was doing it, it would be very odd, wouldn't it?
Well, it sounds odd on the surface, but isn't it a bit odd also that we're kind of looking down, tapping into our phones? I think if we think about this as a new way of interacting with our phones, if we had wide-scale use of it, it would become quite normal.
But it would make train journeys even worse.
Yeah, exactly. So we all know that listening to someone have a very loud conversation next to you on the train is annoying enough as it is when they're trying to get, you know, imagine that when they're trying to get Siri to pronounce their, you know, their mum's name correctly. So yeah, it'd be more frustrating.
Yeah, so some more about Microsoft's vision, as they call it. Let's pop back to that. What else was said?
So what Microsoft have announced to achieve this vision, where essentially you just speak to your phone and your phone will be able to dip into an app, book a taxi, order some food, and really without you ever having to really open an app or interact on that level, Microsoft announced the Microsoft Bot Framework.
So sounds good.
It is. In theory, it's really good. So this contains loads of code and resources that allow developers to build AI bots that work within apps like Skype, Telegram, or Slack. So for instance, you could be chatting on Slack with your colleagues and say, oh, I'd really like to go to this pizza place for lunch. Your pizza bot would reach in, say, great, I made you a reservation at your favourite, and I've even ordered your pepperoni pizza in advance. So this is all about seamless interactions that integrate within existing apps, which is really the exciting bit. And that's the difference, really, because at the minute, Siri or Cortana can say, oh, I can schedule a meeting at 6 p.m. tomorrow, but they can't go in and book your train. You have to open an app and do all of that. And I think if we can have this real seamless type of interaction, that's the really exciting bit. Still quite a long way away, though.
Yeah, and there are privacy issues here, obviously, of artificial intelligence system reaching into all of the different pools of data that are held within different siloed apps within your smartphone. So in order to do your pizza thing, then I guess it would need to know your location data to know which pizza joint you go to the most, or have access to your bank details to see where you paid for that pizza by card. It would also need to know where you are currently. It would need to know transport options. It would need to know an awful lot of things about our lives. And while individual apps collectively know that information all siloed off, there aren't many that have access to all of it. And that's another challenge for Microsoft to overcome, and for all of the smartphone manufacturers to overcome.
Absolutely. And Microsoft did flag this, really. And they pointed out that when you're talking to Cortana in this prospective way, that there'd be multiple opportunities when they'd say, you know, do you want to use these card details? Are you happy with using your location? But essentially, James, you're exactly right. For this system to really work as fluidly as possible, it does really require you giving away a lot of your data and saying, you know what, my AI knows this. And Microsoft would love people to think like that, I think, because they're referring to Cortana as your personalized digital assistant. You know, a bit like offloading a bit of your brain capacity so you don't have to think about where you are. So it really does require you having a bit of a leap of faith, and that's a shift in thinking about how we think about devices and data at the moment.
Yeah, and more presently, there's going to be an update to the current version of Cortana that's coming pretty soon.
Yeah, exactly. So this new Cortana, essentially Microsoft are a bit vague about this, but it's going to be a slightly cleverer Cortana, and this is coming out in the Windows anniversary update. So that's an update a year after Windows 10 was released, which was released in July 2015. It'll be free to all Windows 10 current users, and you're going to see this new Cortana that's able to do stuff like take something from your conversation. Well, you're able to say, book me a meeting tomorrow at 6 p.m. It'll be able to do that and know certain things like, oh, you always use this room. I'm going to assume you're going to want it in this room. So this isn't a huge leap forward, really. Most of the keynote was pretty big thinking that hasn't really put into place yet. But we've got a slightly cleverer Cortana with a few more features that you'll see in this anniversary update coming out this summer.
But credit to Microsoft. They did the demo of it on stage and it worked seamlessly, which is rare.
Yes, exactly. So these voice inputted things are always making mistakes and talking about the wrong thing. And obviously, Microsoft haven't had a great luck recently with their bots.
And let's talk about Microsoft's Tay, which is, I presume, what you're referring to. So Tay was a Twitter bot, an AI-backed Twitter bot that got pulled by Microsoft fairly quickly when it started saying some horrible things. Matt Burgess, tell us briefly what Tay was and why it got pulled.
So about a week ago now, Microsoft announced Tay, which is basically a chatbot run by AI, which is aimed at millennials. It was aimed at 18 to 24-year-olds in the US specifically, but anybody could have a conversation with it. You could speak to it via Twitter. I think you could speak to it via the messaging app Kick and a couple of other different platforms. And people on Twitter specifically started bombarding the chatbot with hundreds, thousands of messages that were not the best messages.
So they were kind of going for right-wing propaganda and horrible things about sexual violence. Basically, what happens when you give the internet a nice thing is it then attempts to break it.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why we can't have nice things on the internet, because people will just troll it, basically, and abuse it. And basically, because this bot was learning from what people were saying, it started repeating the messages. It started saying racist, homophobic things, because this is what we'd taught it to say. We had taught it that these things were what people say, and it's acceptable to say this. And so it just started responding with them to people. And eventually, this caused Microsoft to pull it from the internet.
Because it had turned into a horrible troll, essentially.
Yeah, it was saying bad things to people. It was saying terrible things about controversial and not controversial subjects, but subjects that shouldn't be publicly discussed.
It was a bigot. It was an AI bigot. And there's something not poetic, but sort of poetic and very depressing about Microsoft gave birth to this experimental AI chatbot onto the internet, and within days we turned it into the worst of humanity.
And it shows us what a long way there is to go with this sort of technology, because being able to have a bot that is able to have a natural conversation and speak in natural language, which is what the sort of millennial chatbot was trying to do and speak in sort of very colloquial language, is one of the challenges that these AI systems have to overcome. They have to be able to conversate? That's not even a word.
It is a word. Conversate. They have to conversate.
They have to conversate with us in a way that we can understand and is easy for us to do. Because if they can't, then we're not going to want to use them. They're not going to be user-friendly.
Yeah, that's a really big challenge. So the reason that Microsoft, I suppose, developed Tay and is standing up and making these big statements about a bot framework app ecosystem thing is because it needs to make up lost ground on Apple and Google. So it wants to make its ecosystem for bots the go-to place to make its mobile operating system, to make Windows 10 competitive with iOS and with Android. Matt Reynolds, some of the numbers around this kind of explain why Microsoft's doing what it's doing, just in terms of the number of apps on its operating systems.
Exactly. So in comparison to the Android store and the Apple App Store, the Microsoft Windows Phone store is a little bit of a disadvantage. So as of September 2015, they had 669,000 apps. Sounds quite a lot, but if you compare that with Android and Apple's latest figures they released in mid-2015, they had respectively, so Android had 1.6 million apps and Apple had 1.5 million apps. And so really, for this bot framework to take off and for all of our apps to become integrated and conversational, Microsoft's hoping that developers are going to be flocking to create their own bots and their own AI devices that will really cram the Windows Phone store with great new apps that people want to use.
Yeah, let's touch very briefly on one other bit of news from Build, which was around HoloLens.
Absolutely. So HoloLens, Microsoft announced at Microsoft Build, they'll finally be shipping to developers, qualified developers in the US and Canada, which is exciting because it's been talked about for a long time, but finally people are going to be able to get their hands on it and start developing stuff specifically for the HoloLens.
But there's no mention of a consumer release for this or how much it might cost. It's still the $3,000 developer edition.
Exactly. And as we've seen earlier, there are some partners on board. NASA's been doing stuff and it's been sent up to the ISS and they've been doing interesting stuff with that. But as for consumers, no word on that. I think they're waiting really for developers to develop interesting content and real pioneering stuff that really shows what HoloLens is capable of, but nothing on the consumer front.
One last very brief thing on the consumer front. Windows and Xbox are being merged together a bit more.
Exactly. So Microsoft are merging its Windows and Xbox app stores to encourage developers to make software that works universally across the platform. So instead of developing, say, a game for a Windows phone and then a game for a Windows PC, you'll develop in this single ecosystem and then create an app that works simultaneously across both of them. Again, it's all about getting people using these Windows stores and making developers more keen to develop content for them.
Yeah, so Microsoft is finally waking up to the idea that it's got an awful lot of interesting intellectual property and hardware and software, but it needs to do more to get developers excited about working for its operating systems. And this all-encompassing sort of thought process of bots and single marketplaces and app stores shows that they're starting to get there.
Yeah, absolutely, because you know, as we've seen the success of the App Store and the Android Store, the capability of your device is only as much as what developers are prepared to put on it. You can create a great bit of hardware, but if there's nothing people want to use on it, it's going to sit there, get dusty. And Microsoft really, you know, want to open the doors and say, guys, create great stuff for us. And with this bot framework, it looks like that finally might be starting to happen.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen when Tay will return to Twitter in a less bigoted form, or whatever chatbots that Microsoft might be working on. We'll have to wait and see. Well, thanks very much for taking us through the Best of Build. And Matt Burgess, thanks very much for all your podcasting goodness today. And we will see you again next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.